Welcome to Biohackers Lab, a place where we talk to smart people who are figuring out how to improve health in interesting ways. Join us to discover how you can biohack your life, your body, starting today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Biohackers Lab. I'm your host, Gary Kerwin, and on today's show, I have Dr. Gary Fetke. And the reason I've got Gary on the show today is because he's an orthopedic surgeon who has a lot of interest in nutrition, and not only nutrition, a whole bunch of other health-related scenarios. But he's been one of my low-carb, high-fat experts for many years since he spoke in Cape Town in South Africa at the low-carb, high-fat convention. So I've been following Gary's work for a long time, and I'm so glad I got you on the show today, Gary. But just to give people a little bit of background about yourself, as I mentioned, you're a practicing orthopedic surgeon in Tasmania, Australia. And that you're also a brain cancer survivor, and that was many years ago now, and that's because of that situation there too, that you've had to go through a whole bunch of process of rehabilitation, of course, to be able to move well again and be able to practice as a surgeon. But that's then give you an even deeper passion into the world of nutrition and research and how the benefits will come from eating real foods versus processed foods, I believe. So, Gary, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Well, from one Gary to another, I think I'd like to, we're both four-letter words, so that's always an important start.
Yeah, and before you start, I just want to educate people that your surname, you just gave me such a great little tip there. Would you mind just sharing what your surname actually means?
Well, Fetke is a Germanic origin, but Fet is fat. And if you actually add Fetke, I'm actually was born into trying to work out the origins and sort out the whole issue of fat.
Yeah.
So I didn't even realize I was born into this whole nonsense which we're traveling the path of.
Yeah, not many people probably have their surname also related to their passion.
No. Or, you know, it's all, I'll have a word to my father about that one day.
Yeah. So, Gary, you also, you've gone through exact same situation as Professor Tim Noakes did in South Africa, where you're very vocal about low carbohydrate or high fat diets, and nutrition.
I'll cut in there because I'm actually a great believer in the term low carb, healthy fat.
Okay.
But it doesn't raise the shackles or the ire of anybody if you actually talk about low-carb healthy fat and you talk about it as nuts and the cheese and the avocados and the Mediterranean oils and the fish. And I think it's where a lot of angst develops in the whole market, that it's having healthy fats in the diet rather than deep-fried foods. And for everyone, it's individualizing how much fat they're going to incorporate. Some people want to go, you know, a little bit. Some people want to go, you know, right down the path of hardcore keto with significant athletic performance, and they'll need a lot of healthy fat in their diet. But I dwell on that because I really promote LCHF, but low carb healthy fat, and that's what I talked about at the LCHF summit. You know, we've all got to move away from calling it high fat because it's higher fat, but most important feature of that whole lifestyle change is it's lowering carbohydrate, and particularly the sugar and the refined carbs.
Yeah, well, that's such a good point because, when the word high means, I can have lots of fried foods because it's full of fat, but that's the wrong kind of fat. So definitely a much better word.
And if you mix higher fat and carbohydrate, they're the ones people that really struggle and actually put on weight. You really have to bring your carbohydrate down and put a higher amount of fat, but it's not, you know, bucket loads of fat into the diet. It just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. I actually interview I haven't published yet, but there was another low carb, high healthy fat person from the convention. That was Emily McGuire. And Emily, I don't know if you had a chance. Did you chat with Emily whilst in Cape Town? She was there.
We didn't have a long, but we did meet. Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, Emily also in her chat mentioned the exact same problem, that particularly when it came to women about fat content and how with weight. And so, but now that.
I,
got, I, yeah.
So I often describe it like a game of chess. Like the moves in a game of chess are very simple. You know, adopting LCHF is very simple, but the more you go into it, the more complex it becomes. So it's about individualizing it, you know, rather than just blanket rules for everyone. You know, the first steps for everyone are simple. Cut the processed food, reduce the sugar and carbs, increase the healthy fats. That's really simple, but then incorporating that day-to-day creates the confusion.
Yeah, and tweaking it to your physiology, your situation.
Your age, your requirements, your activity, your sport, and your health. It's all, yeah, it's all, it's simple, but it's complex.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why biohacking is all about, is understanding general concepts, but then trying to hone in your own physiology to get better performance for whatever you're looking to achieve. So coming around to that comparison with Tim Noakes, because you went through a process too with your medical regulatory body in Australia, didn't you?
Yes, I was reported anonymously, but essentially by dietitians who felt that the advice I was giving, and we're going back some years now, and I'm quite proud of the work that, you know, that I've done and others have done, and that raising the awareness of sugar as being a problem. But I was advising, you know, I went to the hospital dietitians, you know, promise, cross my heart, this is what I went. I said, look, hang on, I'm finding the stuff out about sugar. What do you think? And then I started introducing it for my patients, and then all of a sudden I seemed to upset the whole cart within the hospital, because, you know, I don't think there's any difference with hospitals in the UK as to Australia. That hospital food, I think, is too high in energy and doesn't have enough nutrients. And certainly for my patients with diabetes, it's just it's just pushing their blood sugars way out of control. We've got in Tasmania, we've actually got the food guidelines, and they largely in most Australian hospitals, are to recommend at least 2 desserts per day for patients with diabetes, plus biscuits for morning tea and afternoon tea, and to have carbohydrate-laden meals. And if you think I'm joking, I don't. I'm not, because I've actually got the document. So I've got a patient who's in hospital with diabetes, and they're being served up desserts, ice cream, cake at every meal. And then they're confused. This is this whole nutritional confusion we've got. And I think our hospitals should be starting off, and you know, they should be the what I call the temples of health. And all they're doing is over corridors of confusion. I mean, that's patients leave hospital just so confused about what they should and shouldn't be eating. And it's I call it hashtag we can do better, because that's what we've got to do. And diabetes is out of control. So, I was trying to raise this as an issue in the hospital, but then all of a sudden I was treading on toes. I ended up being reported to the medical board, which was all done behind closed doors. Tim's case was very much out in the open, but Tim and I have been communicating regularly and still do. Mine became a higher profile when it ended up being a Senate inquiry looking at the complaints process here in Australia. And my situation was became a test case, I think probably because it's almost Monty Python-esque, a bit like Tim's. You know, you're seriously having a go at a surgeon who's recommending to his patients with diabetes that they reduce their sugar intake. That's it. That was what the fight, you know, at the single hearing that I had. I mean, Tim's went over months, but I had one hearing where I was allowed to present for 20 minutes, 25 minutes, I think. And at the end of it, they asked me one single question, and that was, Dr. Fetke, do you think that advising your patients to reduce their sugar intake is giving specific nutritional advice? That's the one question I've been asked, and I said yes. I had my lawyer there with me, who wasn't allowed to talk, but he's there as my witness. 2.5 years of investigation, one question, and that was it. So, of course, I'm going to tell my patients to reduce their sugar intake, because
that's a condition that's related to diabetes, yeah, and it's good.
Yes.
Yeah, it's understandable advice.
But there have been numerous vested interests, which we've tried to point out along the way, that have, you know, come from the food industry, that have had a lot of input into this, you know, this whole determination. And so it's still ongoing. I mean, I've I've tried to clarify what I'm allowed to speak about, not allowed to speak about. And the, you know, the medical board and their wisdom have written back to me saying, look, we should suggest you get other advice about that. And I kept on going, well, hang on, you're the guys who have given me the caution. You're the ones who have come down with the determination. And you can't actually tell me what I can and I can't do. So as a result of that, it's very hard for me to respect that decision when they can't give me that advice as to what it means. So, therefore, that's why I'm talking to you now.
And did I maybe see it correct somewhere that a part of their ruling in your situation was that they said even if the advice that you're giving at current, you know, about diabetes becomes mainstream nutritional evidence, that you are still not allowed to mention it? Is that, did I get that right?
That's absolutely right. It's the strangest wording of a document. I mean, I honestly hope for their sake that they just realize one day that they've made a mistake and that they've done a really badly worded document, because I'm hoping it's just related to the word incompetence rather than actually measured, you know, decision-making.
Yeah.
And because it is a silly comment, particularly as in Australia now that the best-selling non-fiction book is the CSIRO low-carb diet for diabetes. So, I mean, it's now, CSIRO is our major scientific body. It's the best-selling book, and the author of that book was in my lounge room 2 years ago. We were chatting about it and how to implement it. So, I mean, I'm actually completely on board with low carb. Our major scientific body is the best-selling book in talking low carb, and yet on the, you know, theoretically, I'm not allowed to talk about it.
And that just bamboozled me. Like, how does the medical body, they want best care for the patients but don't tell the patients about best care situations? That was so confusing.
It just keeps shifting around. And I think I'll probably best not to say too much more because I'll become unkind.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch on it because I know it's there's going to be a lot more we're going to talk about. So,
once you see the results of low carbohydrate management, particularly in diabetes, once you see the results, you cannot unsee them. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, because of the presence we have with my patients and in social media and or media, the results we know are just outstanding. And you know, this is diabetes.co.uk did that study with tens of thousands of patients last year, showing outstanding improvements. We've audited our, you know, the patients who've come to the Nutrition for Life Centre that we've got in Tasmania, and they get the same results, you know, improvement in blood glucose, reduction of medications, better control. But more importantly, the patients have become empowered. And this is a story right across the LCHF world, that people who have been following dietary guidelines for decades, having health issues despite that, being told that they're failures when they fail their Jenny Craig, Weight Watchers, this diet, that diet, have all of a sudden become empowered when they actually realize that the advice they've been following, you know, that food pyramid advice for decades or shapes thereof, has actually been just making them sicker. So, again, these results mean that you just can't be silenced about it.
And I also felt, especially knowing with the orthopedic world, that you're presented with patients with diabetic complications who potentially need amputations. And, for example, I saw a documentary a while back with Jamie Oliver on this side in the UK, and he was highlighting the rates of limb amputations within the UK diabetic population and how that was higher than what was happening even in a war situation for the British. He was saying it's just incredible that more normal people are getting amputated than soldiers. And then he went to the Mexico situation, which was just insane, the diabetic explosion over there and the amputation concern too for those patients. So, yeah, you definitely want to, even as a surgeon, understand that situation.
The complications of diabetes, whether it's type 1 or type 2, are avoidable, preventable. I can keep repeating that. That's just, and in diabetes, you have an intolerance of carbohydrate. you have an inability to metabolize the glucose load that you present your body with. Now, whether or not it's an autoimmune problem, type 1, or it's how much you eat and you have an insulin resistance in type 2, you cannot handle the glucose load that your body's got. And over time, that catches up with you. And the amputations are just the simple number at the end of the day. But however, for every person I'm amputating a leg, there's 20 or 30 people that I've had a nibble at their feet beforehand. You know, that they've, you know, they've had a toe op, or they've had a debridement of an ulcer, or they're going to a podiatrist and they're having daily dressings or infections or antibiotics. So the number of people with amputations is the tip of the iceberg. And, you know, I get slightly misquoted on that when I say I'm amputating every week. I'm actually amputating bits of people's feet. And I'm chopping off too many legs, but nonetheless, every week, every clinic at the hospital, there's something that we, you know, and nobody wants to hear of it. We're nibbling away and bits of their feet all the time.
It's true. I was going to say, it's not only the full amputation. It's just, even start with it's a couple of toes or whatever happens to be, and it just progresses.
Just an ulcer on your foot can go on for months and months and months, which all of a sudden, you know, makes people housebound, restricts their activity, restricts their shoe wear, gives them chronic pain. And so, you know, what Jamie refers to, and I remember that article, you know, and it's horrific, the number of amputations. But, you know, it's at least 100 times worse than that with the pre-amputation scenarios.
Good point, yeah. So talking now about diabetes, you recently just gave a fantastic talk, I believe, in Australia to another group. And could you mention the toast situation?
Well, strangely enough, I've got a piece. This is raisin toast. I've got to admit, I went around. I haven't bought this. Okay, I went around the hospital the other morning after breakfast, and I gathered up a whole lot of leftover pieces of toast. And most people are aware of toast and are aware of the cooking of toast, and it's called the Maillard reaction. And I use that to explain the complications of diabetes. So the Maillard reaction in a piece of toast or cooking, it doesn't matter if it's browning a cake or anything, is the combination of glucose or sugar with protein under the effect of heat. So that creates, it's similar to caramelizing something, but effectively when you combine glucose or sugar with protein and heat, you get toast. It browns, dries out, excuse me. And the same thing happens with diabetes. Diabetes is an inability to control the blood glucose load, the glucose that you present the body with. So if you eat too much carbohydrate, which is just glucose, too much sugar, that spills over into the bloodstream, and if you cannot metabolize it properly, then around about two-thirds of it metabolized, it is transported into the tissue. And if that's beyond what the cell can handle, then the glucose that's gone from your blood into your tissue builds up. It then reacts with the protein in the tissue, and that's called the Maillard reaction. So every time your blood glucose goes up, now that happens if you're insulin resistant, you're overweight, or you have diabetes. So let's start talking about two pre-diabetic conditions, insulin resistance and overweight. The Maillard reaction is occurring. So what you're effectively doing is you're toasting every cell in your body. You're toasting your brain, you're toasting your eyes, you're toasting your kidneys, you're toasting your, you know, your arteries. There's also a microvascular component in there as well. But at a tissue level, we've got toasting occurring right through the body. So if you want elevated blood glucose over time, you're slowly but surely toasting your brain. And if you can't get it from that, if you don't understand it from that, then I can't make it any simpler. Diabetes is an allergy, an intolerance to the carbohydrate that you present your body with. And the same thing with a kid with a nut allergy. You don't give a kid with a nut allergy peanuts and then give them an adrenaline pen. And, you know, because it's going to kill them, you know, those peanuts are going to kill them unless they have medication. And the same thing with diabetes. If you give someone carbohydrate over and over and over, it's going to kill them. Not as quickly as a nut allergy, but it's going to kill them. And along the way, you know, you're going to look like a piece of toast.
I thought that was that was an incredible way of trying to explain a physiological situation. I think a lot of people can think of that, and in a sense that sort of describes chronic inflammation and metabolic dysfunction and how the body's not coping.
I mean, there's another one of my talks where I talk about inflammation, which is a combination of fructose, refined carbohydrates and the polyunsaturated oils, but it ties on. But the Maillard reaction is just elevated blood glucose. That's it, which becomes elevated tissue glucose. And look, it's completely avoidable. I often say, you know, God wasn't stupid enough to make our brains completely dependent on one fuel source called glucose. That's why we've got these things called ketones. We can metabolize protein into fuels for the brain as well. So we're not dependent on sugar and carbohydrate. It's just there's no physiological reaction in the body that requires glucose or fructose. We need essential oil, essential fats. We need essential proteins, but there's no essential carbohydrate requirement.
Yeah, you don't get essential carbohydrates as a supplement, do you?
No. But they put gelatin in the capsule. So, yeah, probably there is a bit of that.
Okay. Yeah, because talking about ketones, I had a ketone researcher from Oxford University on recently, Brianna Stubbs, and she gave some good insight into that and the exciting world of ketones potentially for therapeutic care with cancer, maybe. Yeah, we gently touched on that. But do you think even then with your history, your own personal story, having to manage your own cancer therapy, that nutrition was a big part for you?
Yeah, I evolved down that pathway. I mean, on top of my own personal cancer history, I was a fat kid. I was pre-diabetic. I had high blood pressure. And so I've been interested in nutrition for a long time because I was, you know, eating, I call that food pyramid. If you eat by the food pyramid, I think you'll die by the food pyramid. And along the way, you'll look like the food pyramid. And that's where we've been at for a long time. So I've been looking after my health, I think, for decades, but getting sicker, that was a strange thing. So ultimately, I stumbled down this path of sugar, and then the low-carb concept flowed on from that. So a lot of this research is, you know, it's my self-preservation to start off with, which is the story of many of the low-carb, you know, people that started. Now, whether or not that you started 10 years ago or 20 years ago, or in my case, eight years now, you're driven down the path of looking after yourself and then looking after, you know, seeing the benefits for yourself, then for your family. I then experimented on my theatre team, you know, not my patients, but, you know, started talking, and they all got better and healthier, and then all of a sudden you can't start telling it to your patients. So understanding that, you know, going back and becoming a mature age student of biochemistry has just been a really, really, you know, interesting pathway. And I'm still learning. I went to the low-carb Breckenridge meeting. Every one of the speakers there taught me something that I didn't know. And I've been engrossed in this topic for years. But I'm still learning. And anybody who says they've got it worked out doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no human being in this world who knows everything. There's always factors that come up. So, and talking about then having to invert a pyramid, you know, the whole food pyramid triangle. I also, when I was looking into your biography, you've had a passion for looking sort of like a devil's advocate on the other side of situations. Is that right?
I have big, grand ideas. So I wrote a book called Inversion, One Man's Answer for World Peace and Global Health, you know, just a little topic. And I needed to write that some years ago because it is the way I think. And if like, and from the world peace point of view, I was looking at, we tend to dwell upon our differences rather than our similarities. And, you know, and whether or not it's religion or it's the color of our skin or the way we behave, we focus on the fact, oh, that person's different. Whereas, in fact, we've got far more in common than we think. So I've been trying to do some work behind the scenes, looking at the common ground between LCHF, paleo in Australia, the CSIRO diet, the recommendations of the Diabetes Society, and 90% of what we're all talking about is the same. But the media and the press and, you know, people who live one way or another just focus on the differences. And just imagine what would happen to the world media about nutrition and cookbooks and everything if everyone got up and said, actually 90% of what I'm saying is the same as what you're saying. Let's get back to eating real food, which is fresh, local, and seasonal. That's what I'm on about. Now, if you actually look at the definition of what food is fresh, local, and seasonal, by definition, it becomes low in sugar, low in carbohydrate, and a normal amount of protein, and a certain amount of healthy fats. Now, like fruit, and the natural source of sugar in society is fruit, and that's only available seasonally at the end of summer, beginning of autumn, and then you're actually fighting the rest of the animal kingdom to eat it at the same time. And that fruit is the sugar in the fruit is our survival mechanism, and that's why we're addicted to this stuff. Because as an animal or in the animal kingdom, if we can get hold of fruit at that time, it will make us fat for winter hibernation. That's it. So therefore, we're completely driven by behaviour. Now, everybody will have that in their own country. In Australia, we've got possums, and they'll come through and they'll strip the tree bare 2 days before the fruit is ripe. But it's the sugar content's gone up for them, and they'll eat it and eat it and eat it. It drives behaviour, and that driven behaviour allows them to keep eating more and more, and it'll turn into fat for winter hibernation. So at the most primitive level, sugar is there for our survival, just like water. And so it's really hard to kick the habit for people of eating sugar because it's a basic survival mechanism. And so only with a bit of knowledge you can start addressing that. Mm-hmm. And then understanding that, you know, it's not just the food driving behavior, it's the market driving behavior, the shops driving it, and then the whole culture. So if you go to a party now, you can't, you know, if there's a birthday party, there's always cake and there's grog and there's junk food. If you go to the shops, you can totally confused by all the labeling that's there. And yet we've got a culture of celebration, which has been largely based around food for the last several hundred years. So this is really hard to overcome that when we've got this abundance of food on our doorstep every single day. It's really hard for people to overcome that. But if you give them the knowledge and the will and the support and a degree of accountability and that motivation, then they can actually start making differences, as you well know. Mm-hmm. You know, lots of people make this lifestyle change. So it's not just what you eat, it's the whole environment that needs to change to make, you know, to help people along.
Yeah, behavior is always the big driving factor for decision making. So if you're stuck in a certain environment or way that you do things, then it's hard to change a process in your life. So I love the idea of the seasonal food too, because that also goes into ecology of actually what's maybe better for this world, that humans don't try force growth of certain foods and I guess get into you see it all the time where you'll have certain food groups where you think that it's terrible, it tastes disgusting because it's out of season, but it tastes amazing when it's in season. But I'm being fed it out of season, and is that really the best thing to eat right now? So I think you're one of the first people in the low carb healthy fat community that I've heard talking about also focus on eating seasonal foods.
And not just seasonally. I actually think we also focus on our latitude as well.
Okay.
So the further you get away from the equator, the less vitamin D you have. And vitamin D is actually a central part of fructose, of the clearing mechanism of the produce of fructose. So if you get closer to the equator, then you can afford to actually have more fruit in your diet because you've actually got more sunlight to metabolize the whole downstream effects of fructose. Whereas the further you get away from the equator, the less you have the ability to metabolize it. So there are many conditions which have a latitudinal effect, and particularly the neuropathies like multiple sclerosis. And some of the cancers change as well. I mean, I don't have all the answers, but it's really interesting to observe these things and to come up with hypotheses, which you can then start testing. But it's hard to test nutritional hypotheses because there's so many variabilities. Particularly, you know, as you said, you can actually eat food well and truly out of season all year round. And then that becomes a whole environmental issue as well.
Yeah. And I love that you bring up the point of the latitude too, because I have a personal interest also just following, I don't know if you know about the quantum health movements where people are looking at light as energy and mitochondrial stimulation and how they are very specific also on latitude and how it influences what you eat. And it's this exact same concept, and that's more to get down to the mitochondrial level. So, again, that's fascinating to hear that. I don't know if many people think, oh, if I'm based in the Southern Hemisphere, in Australia or South Africa, that my diet there might be different to if I was at the Seychelles near the equator, or if I was up north in Scandinavia somewhere or the UK.
Well, it's crazy that you can eat tropical fruit, you know, a long way away from the equator. Whereas, you know, the temperate fruits, you know, should be eaten in temperate climates, and the tropical fruits should be eaten in tropical climates. And we've come up with convenience, and we like to be, you know, to hear about this. We like to eat fruit out of season all over time. And that comes back to that whole term of fruit and veg, which is that's become a cultural thing as well, when in fact that's just a term made up in 1991.
Yeah, the five fruits and veg a day.
The fruit and veg. I mean, most people were actually born and raised, I'm an old guy now, in that you were raised on meat and three veg. And so the term fruit and veg has been infiltrated into our marketing and now into our consciousness that everyone believes, you've got to have fruit and veg. Well, in fact, you're supposed to have veg, and meat has an integral part in the nutrient spectrum, but the fruit's been, you know, snuck in there. And that was all came down to a meeting that started in 1991 in California between the American Cancer Association and I think it was 44 well-meaning food companies, including McDonald's and Walmart. You know, and so, therefore, that became part of our culture, fruit and veg. And it's unfortunately, you know, it's there now. And so to try and tell people that the amount of fruit and having all of that all year round every day is, not actually helping their health, you know, I get myself into a lot of hot water over there. There's a whole lot of talk about, there's a talk that I give on that one, which is a separate issue. And I'm not saying that fruit is unhealthy. I'm just saying that it's over-marketed as being of health benefits for us. So green leafy vegetables, gram for gram, beetroot on phytonutrients, fiber, minerals and vitamins. So we should be having our green vegetables, which are actually available all year round. Again, you used to go to the greengrocer. You didn't go to the fruit and veg shop. And so we've traditionally been able to have vegetables all year round and eat fruit seasonally. And I think we need to go back to that concept.
I think that's so, again, where it's so true from a marketing perspective, how many people have believed that they have to start the day with a glass of fruit juice or a big bowl of fruit with yogurt, or for example, on their muesli or their cereal, because that has been shown to be healthy. And so I must eat that year round. The fruit component is not an essential nutrient. You can get way better nutrition from from vegetables in this case, for example?
Well, I used to have that healthy breakfast. I'd have my bowl of muesli, low-fat yogurt on it, wash it down with a glass of fresh fruit juice, have my honey on a grain toast, and you know a little bit of chocolate because you know can't possibly do any harm. And I was having 25 to 30 teaspoons of sugar for breakfast. And in retrospect, my blood glucose was going up like that, screamed up, had an insulin response. 2 hours later, I was starving and hungry and, you know, looking for a bit of cake with morning tea. And I used to be on that roller coaster, and now my blood glucose is like that because I just haven't, you know, set the whole system off. So it's just interesting, you know, when you look back on it, I go, how the hell did I do that? But I was doing the right thing on the advice that I was thought was right and that I was actually giving my patients. You know, and I would give them a hard time just like I was giving myself a hard time. You know, you got to eat less and exercise more and you got to eat healthy. And they'd say, I am eating healthy, doc. And I'm saying, I'm eating healthy and I'm still getting into the same trouble. I mean, I wish I'd known about this decades earlier for myself and for my patients, but, you know, now I'm trying to make amends. I mean, you'd like this. I used to be the cake judge at the hospital.
Okay.
And I wouldn't take plasters off kids unless they brought me a chocolate cake for to take the plaster off. So I have got a lot of, you know, a lot of guilt to overcome.
You know. So how did you that? If you had such a good sweet tooth then, that must have in itself, that behavior, been such a struggle to overcome, was it? Did you find?
No, again, it's once you get the knowledge, then you're empowered. And if you're a smoker nowadays, I'm actually okay with it because there's so much information out there to tell you that it's a dumb thing to do. Because you know, if you want to smoke now in Australia, there's plain packaging and there's, you know, labels saying that they're, you know, terrible for your health. So you've made in my mind, you've made a conscious decision to be an idiot if you smoke nowadays. And I'm okay with it. I say, okay, you've got enough information. But if you want to eat right and do the right thing by your body and put the right fuel in your tank, there is still so much confusion out there. And I'm part of that confusion. You're part of that confusion. Tim Noakes is part of that confusion. The dietitians' associations are part of that confusion. You know, the food manufacturers are not interested in sorting this one out because they've got billions of dollars tied up with it. And you know, and you can get more and more cynical about it, but there's so much confusion out there and misinformation that why am I to be, you know, considered any more of an authority than anyone else? And, you know, beforehand, we just quickly touched on the bias of research and how hard it is to interpret research. And, you know, most of us in medicine think that nutritional science is the same as medical science, and they're not, because medical science is based on the scientific method of observation, hypothesis, test, retest, and then implement maybe a finding. And I think that's an interesting topic to challenge on another day. But nutritional science has been around for the last 100 years, and largely it was based on how do we make this food more effectively? How do we improve shelf life? How do we improve profitability? How do we work on the bliss point so we increase sales? So we've had all this nutritional science coming along. We called it science, but in fact it hasn't been scientific at all. It's about increasing profitability for the industry. And so when you actually bring those all together, it's now just in the last several years that more and more people are waking up and going, hang on, that was nonsense. You know? And Zoe Harcum's done a lot of work on, you know, putting that stuff, you know, so that's, the science wasn't there. And unfortunately, we'll have decades of a tail effect of that, the advice we've been giving.
Yeah, as we're talking now in 2017, the saturated fat concern in nutritional science and how that's been toppled, hopefully, that's this freaking out about if you touch saturated fat, you're going to just pass away. And hopefully, yeah, that food money. I don't like it. I personally been following this movement for so long, I've looked at my own cardiovascular risk factors and saturated fat, and when I see foods that especially processed foods that highlight, oh, this is really good for you because it's low fat, we're a processed food with low fat, and I thought, oh no, as you mentioned, the polyunsaturates and what other unstable fats have they had to substitute the saturated fat for this food, and yet it's been sold as healthy, blatantly to someone.
Well, I call it food product. I can't possibly call that stuff food. If it's in a package, it's a food product. It's a food lookalike or it's a food substitute, but it's definitely not food. And I actually take offense now for all of the world. I actually have to call food real food now.
Yeah.
The term, I eat real food, just eat real food. Why can't we just call it just equal food? Just eat food.
We
call it
food. It is. It's such a weird world we live in that we have to define something that is natural as natural, because you can't just use the word food for it anymore. There are so many parts in health now where natural is seen as unnatural, which I find funny. And then you have to defend why a natural physiological process is actually okay for you. Like eating real food is actually okay for you.
That's right. That's right. I think we should be eating towards our environment. I think we should be eating towards our needs. I know it sounds really, really simple, but rather than eating to a guideline or eating to this calories in, calories out thing, which really is being debunked, and the path I'm sort of meandering down at the moment is I think we need to reconsider that whole concept and forget energy and eat to our nutrient requirements. And that's, I think it's a really exciting pathway to actually think about, okay, how much do I get out of my food? Because I think we need a certain amount of vitamins, we need a certain amount of essential fats, essential proteins, essential minerals that we're in our body. And it's almost impossible in a Western society to miss out on enough calories. It's there in abundance. And as we chase those nutrients, I use the example of someone eating a pizza. It's got a truckload of calories in it, but it doesn't have a lot of nutrients. So at the end of that meal, the person will go, actually, I'm craving more nutrients. So they go and eat a second pizza, and a third pizza. I'm using it, as an exaggeration, but that's what we tend to do. We're chasing nutrients, and along the way, we're actually struggling to find that without actually coming on board with a lot of calories. So I think that's part of our obesity, a part of our portion size problem, is we don't have enough nutrients, which then raises to me another concern that I've been thinking about again recently, is that even if you want to eat healthy and you're now making these decisions, which I believe predominantly for most people is probably better down this LCHF pathway, that you're going to struggle to actually get those nutrients if you look for produce. And that's because our soil is now being depleted of our nutrients, because the nutrition of our soil determines the nutrition of our food, and then that determines the nutrition of our bodies. One thing I've come across which is draws some concern is that it's actually only 4% of the world's surface is actually agricultural land that we till and we plough and we actually farm for our produce.
You said 4%.
4%, only 4%. Yeah. And the World Bank actually said came back as about 3.5%. So I'm probably being generous in saying it's 4%. And then we've got about 14% of forest and brush pasture and meadows that can possibly be grazed. But we've lost, just in the last 10 years, 30% of the organic matter in our topsoil, and about 80% of our organic matter over the last 100 years. So our topsoil in that 4% of the planet's surface that we can actually tend, we've lost 80% of the organic matter. And you know that in your garden, your backyard garden, when you mulch the soil down and you put the organic matter in, the worms come back, the moisture is retained, it becomes a lot healthier. And it's full of bacteria and fungi, and they can actually break down the minerals and nutrients that we require that we ultimately put into the food. So, you know, that's where my thinking and a bit of research is going down that pathway at the moment. And if our croplands are being dried out, we rip through the topsoil, turn it over, we put fertilizers into the soil, which promotes growth, but it doesn't promote bacteria and it doesn't promote the fungi that we need to actually to break down those minerals that are actually down there deep in our topsoil. And, you know, this is where we need to, and this is the beautiful thing where, you know, ruminants, or we call cows, sheep, goats, bison, buffalo, they actually have a role to play. We've been blaming them, it's been alleged. It's another one of those things which I think is a complete myth. The cows are the cause of our greenhouse gases and our global warming. I just said, there's approximately the same number of ruminants, cows, sheep, goats, bison, buffalo, on the planet as there was about 100 years ago. It's an estimation. And yes, they're fabulous, because what they do is they eat grass. The grass regrows and takes carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. But they actually turn that grass into food that we can eat. And you and I, we've both got these teeth here which are designed to actually eat meat. Now, our teeth are not designed to be full-time vegetarians. You know, and I've only got one stomach, you know. I mean, cows have got four stomachs to turn grass into something that we can eat, which is full of the right fats, the right minerals, including iron, that we actually need, which you're going to struggle to get from plant-based, you know, foods. I'm actually still a great believer in plant-based foods, but we need meat in there. We need essential fats. So I think it's really important to actually maybe, you know, I use a hashtag at the moment occasionally called, you know, hashtag innocent cows. You know, I think they've been overplayed for, you know, a whole lot of this stuff. You know, we blame the cows for greenhouse gases. Number two on the list of the animal kingdom that's actually causing greenhouse gases, up to 15% of greenhouse gas methane in the stuff I've been reading has been caused by, would you believe it, termites, cockroaches, millipedes, and scarab beetles. And we're not all running around, you know, saying we've got to wipe out all the millipedes and beetles and termites on the planet. But they've got little methane-producing organisms in their tails, and they're actually, by sheer volume, creating an enormous amount of methane.
Yeah, think how many insects there are in this world.
If we look at that, here's a number crunch. On the planet, there's about 6 to 7 billion people, you know, approximately. In one tablespoon of feces or cow dung, for instance, is about 6 to 7 billion living creatures. And if you've got healthy soil, again, about a tablespoon has about the same number of living creatures. So when we play with our gut by what we eat or what chemicals we put into our gut or what antibiotics we put in or how we tend our soil, just we're affecting more living creatures in one tablespoon of our feces or one tablespoon of our dirt than there are human beings on the planet. And just to, you know, to put that into perspective for those groups who are really promoting animal rights and vegetarianism, you know, that we're affecting more living creatures on the planet than we are human beings with every action we have. Okay. So it's not really considered that often.
Yeah. So are you a fan of? I know we're talking now even just about insects, just insect protein?
I was talking about this 20 years ago. You know, I think that's our method of space travel. You know, I think there's a role for that. You know, it's a high protein thing. They crunch and they get stuck in your teeth. But it is actually a food source which is potentially renewable with a low ecological cost. I mean, I don't know the answer for it, but I've certainly had my grasshopper snacks, couple of times in the last year. You know, it came to me in a packet. I'm sorry, it was processed. But and this is an area of exploration over time, because we just need to get smarter with our food. But I actually think there's a big role for actually putting and grazing our cattle, grazing our ruminants in a really clever way, which actually restores organic matter to the topsoil. And there's a great book I've just read recently called Cows Save the Planet. Well worth reading, because it's one of these inversions. It flips your whole thinking around. Rather than actually cattle stripping our topsoil, they're actually regrowing our topsoil. And rather than our agricultural practices at the moment, which is really ploughing through the dirt and ripping through those bacteria and fungi that we actually need to drag the nutrients out of the soil. Interesting times. That's really what it boils down to.
Yeah, no, very. And that is, as you mentioned, the rabbit holes that you end up looking at, where you start wanting to eat real foods, you understand the physiology and the benefits of that, but then you actually want to know how do I make natural foods well. And in this case, it's the same. How would I allow the meat that I eat to actually itself be well whilst it's grazing and growing? So like the cows, how do I make them healthy with what they eat, but then how do they fit into the whole ecosystem? And that is even just about respecting good food, and the quality of food makes a difference to you too.
Interestingly, it's actually if you raise cattle on grain, they'll grow a bit quicker and a bit more efficiently. But nobody's putting into the equation that there's an ecological cost of growing the grain to feed the cattle. And the more you actually look at it, again, it's like that game of chess. It's all, you know, the pieces are all pretty simple, but it just gets more and more complex. I'm a believer that we've actually got to maybe move our cattle and have them on that pasture that we can't possibly till and plow. I think it's crazy that we're spending, you know, significant amounts of our agricultural land growing grain for cattle production on feedlots. I think that's So, you know, I'm a greenie down that pathway. I've got no troubles with that. You know, I think, and I'll agree with the animal rights people that that's a silly way for us to be doing it. But I think we can get a lot smarter, and rather than just blaming cattle for our greenhouse problems, we can actually institute that. And, you know, having meat and having pasture-fed meat, which is much lower in omega-6 fatty acids than that of a grain-fed cattle, is actually better, and it fits within the whole concept of low-carb, healthy fat. You know, we do need meat, but it's best if it comes from pasture and hasn't been, you know, isn't, and is as low in omega-6 fatty acids as practical. You know, a lot of the stuff we do is all very unnatural, but let's shift towards things which are going to benefit our health. Look at the quality of the food, which you alluded to, and look at the nutrient value of the food. And rather than just chasing calories and trying to restrict calories.
And that's the same as, so is that when you're talking about the calories, is that the same concept of empty calories? Is that, are we touching?
It's the same concept. Like the carbohydrate-laden foods are, which you find in hospital food, again, I'll bring it back to that, is that they're high in calories, but they're low in nutrients. I mean, there's nothing in sugar that isn't just calories. It's glucose and fructose. That's all it is. It has got no nutrient value whatsoever. And the more refined we have our carbohydrates, the more we mill our grains down, we mill the rice down, the more we lose all of that. Even potatoes, you know, taking the skins off them and growing them in paddocks which have been treated with what we call NPK in Australia, which is really just growth chemicals rather than actually, you know, the other minerals and things that you actually require out of the soil. It's gotten dumb, you know, and unfortunately our food industry has demanded quantity rather than quality. And waiting for the governments to change them to get that concept on board, or waiting for the market to get that, you know, the companies doing that production to get on board, that won't happen. So the only way around it is, and we can see this happening, is that the population-based, ground-based education is that the people are now demanding that product and the industry has to respond to it. So, I mean, that's why I'm talking with you now. And, you know, we're hoping that this is not going to be just a one-on-one conversation, that it will reach out beyond the scope of, you know, our respective, you know, office spaces here. That's the power of the people, and that's where this message has to go forward, because the people will drive the behavior of the food manufacturers.
Yeah.
And that's why we have to keep going with this message.
Yeah. So I think out of the points I've got there, that the behavior of the consumer dictates the market, and that's so true. You know, the behavior of the consumer as to what they buy, and this is the term of buying power. If all the money is flowing in one direction, that's where all the commercial companies are going to focus on. So I think it's what we've learned today in today's interview is that you want to try focus on real foods, and we know from a health perspective why. I believe you've given good education basis for that. But then once you start on that journey, that you'll be demanding higher quality nutritious foods, and then you're starting to look at where is your food source from, and hopefully it is pasture raised animals that are eating the foods that they should be eating, vegetables that are growing in nutrient rich soils, and then that's going to have an overall benefit for you and the world. So
I think it's a win-win situation.
Yeah,
when you start looking at in that perspective, we're just going to get smarter with it.
Yeah. And it's that silly concept I think we touched on of how sometimes natural is seen as unnatural, where people might think, but so what? You just let the animals do what they do, and there's a cycle, and then you can gain benefit from it, but you don't. But that's actually going to work. natural, you know, the efficient farming methods, in this case about herding animals and they follow each other. And yeah, it just makes so much good sense too. And it's better for everyone.
Well, I think it's better over the next 100 years from the farmer, you know, who's actually trying to get his, you know, his profits up and maintain livestock. There is going to be several years of turnaround to get to that point. But, you know, I think that's going to be the pill that the system needs to swallow before we turn it around.
Mm. So, Gary, we're coming up to roughly the hour mark here, and there's going to always be so much more that we can talk about. I mean, you're full of knowledge too, and that's why I've got you on the show. But if anyone wants to connect further with you, follow your thinking, your research, how best can they do that?
Well, on a day-to-day basis, I'm on Twitter as FructoseNo or Gary Fetke. Because of the politics of my life, my wife Belinda has taken over the Facebook side of it. So go to Belinda Fetke No Fructose. And then there's a website, nofructose.com, where a lot of this stuff is on. Some of the talks, the videos are there. And, you know, it's a bit of a stepping stone. But, I think everyone starts on this journey, and it's a matter of, you know, compiling as much knowledge as you can. So come and join me on Twitter or Belinda on Facebook. I'm still involved there, but she's really doing the hard yakka there. And she's been a fabulous support. And most people who are actually, you know, copped a hammering for speaking out about this can't do it alone. You know, they need good family support. They need friends. And catching up with you is part of that support, you know, for each other. So, you know, thanks for your time as well.
No problems. And, yeah, I guess, as you would know, there are a lot of people who follow the LCHF living, and it's only growing. And I do believe, you know, they're fully supporting you, as they do like Tim Noakes in South Africa. It's there is a large community that you might not be able to meet all the time, but they're listening, and they're wishing the best for you.
No, I thank you. I thank all of those people who do contact us, and even if they don't, my defense in all of this, Tim's defense in all of this, is that every person who's doing this is leading by example. And I often say that to people, you lead by example, and people come up to you and say, look, you look great, you're a lot healthier, you've lost weight, your skin's better, your attitude's better, you're not as depressed. What's your answer? And you say, well, I'm just eating real food. Oops, sorry, you're just eating food. Okay.
I like that. Yeah, I was going to say, I'm going to use that food substitute one.
So, look, if everyone leads by example, that's the best support that I can have. That's the best support Tim can do, mm-hmm. Can have as well. Mm-hmm. And we thank everyone.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I obviously do.
Yeah. Well, just for everyone to know, I'm going to link to all those references in the show notes for this episode on the website. So if you want to contact Dr. Fetke, that's how you're going to be able to do it through those links if you want. So, again, thank you so much for coming on to the show today.
Thank you.
All right. See you later. Take care. Bye-bye.